This episode of The Big Interview was first broadcast on the 29th of November 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello, I'm Steve Bloomfield, and this is The Big Interview on Monocle 24, our one-on-one show where people with fascinating lives, enviable careers, and plenty of great tales sit down and tell us how they got to where they are today, what inspires them, and what makes them tick. My guest today is Daniel Liebeskind, one of the world's greatest and most interesting architects. His buildings are not the tallest or the shiniest, nor are they ever found in countries run by autocratic regimes. He builds in democracies for people, not himself. And some of his most memorable commissions have been about remembrance, from the Jewish Museum in Berlin to his role as master planner of New York's Ground Zero. Daniel Liebeskind, thank you very much for joining us today. You're in London briefly on the way back from various places in Europe back to New York. Where is home for you? Where do you say you're from?
That's a good question. You know, my home is in New York, but I also live in Milan. I also, you know, consider Berlin my home. You know, the air is my home as well, because I'm so much in the air going, you know, from Africa to Asia to South America, back home to New York. So, but, you know, home is really New York.
So where would you say that you're from?
Well, you know, where am I from? I was an immigrant several times. I was born in Poland. I lived in Israel, live in New York. We moved 18 times across the oceans with our children, not as tourists, but, you know, we lived in Italy. We lived in England. We lived in Helsinki. We lived in Canada. We lived in Detroit. We lived in L.A. We lived in Paris. I don't know. We lived in so many places that it's hard to say, where are you from? You're from the world.
And is that, do you think you've moved that many times because you come from Poland, you were born in Poland after the Second World War. As a Jew growing up in Poland after the Second World War, it must have been a very strange place. I notice you don't necessarily say you're Polish.
You know, I used to not say Polish because I grew up under tremendous oppression, communism, anti-Semitism, a deadly combination. But when I have returned to Poland, and I have been there many times, and now I'm building, you know, the tallest residential tower in Warsaw, I consider myself Polish again because Poland is so different from the Poland that I left. So the world is interesting because it changes and it transforms itself. And you can never just say it's the past because the past continues to grow into the future.
Do you still feel then some affinity for Poland now that you perhaps didn't when you were growing up?
Oh, absolutely. Well, many Polish things have been deep in my heart, from Polish music to Polish literature. I read Polish. I speak Polish. So it is my country. It is my home. But, you know, it has been transformed in time, you know, from times of oppression. After the Holocaust, my parents were survivors. Living in the 40s, 50s in Poland was not pleasant. And we were, you know, lucky to be let out when the Iron Curtain sort of cracked. And Jews were kind of expelled to Israel. So we were in Israel for a while. And then we wound up in New York. So I always say I had two promised lands.
What do you remember from your childhood now? And do you ever really actually think much about when you were young?
I don't really think much about it. I'm not a nostalgic person, but certainly it has colored my perception of the world. You know, the grayness of Poland and the conformity contrasted with the blue skies of the Mediterranean in Tel Aviv, and then with the amazing vistas of New York and the Bronx, where I wound up. That does form a sort of a composition in my mind, a musical structure, which is like a continuo, basso continuo, you know, in a Baroque piece of music.
You mentioned that you've had two promised lands. Let's talk about that first, Israel, because many Jews who grew up in Europe move to Israel or have moved to Israel, and then they stay there. They feel that they are finally home. Did you not feel that?
You know, it was not my decision to make. It was my parents. But my parents kind of disagreed. My father was very much a sort of socially minded person. He wanted to live on the kibbutz. So we were on the kibbutz for a while. My mother, who was kind of an anarchic personality and an entrepreneur in her own way, did not like the kibbutz where she had a sister. It was difficult to get a job. Israel was a young country. It was just a few years old. So my parents decided, my father, that he would come to America. He had his only a surviving sister who survived Auschwitz, and he was determined to come to America. And so he did.
Were you ever tempted to, once you were in America, were you ever tempted to go back to Israel to make that the sort of the family home again?
No, not really. I mean, I've been back, and I am always back in Israel, but you know, to me, it's like continuity in New York, you know, which is the capital where Jewish people are at home, or is it Tel Aviv or New York? Probably New York.
So what's your relationship like with Israel? Because for every Jew, there is a relationship with Israel, which is verges from the incredibly weak and threadbare to the incredibly strong. Where do you stand on it?
No, I love Israel. I have the family in Israel represents the whole of, I would say, Jewishness. On one hand, you have the Chalutzim. People came to Palestine to create, you know, roads, and were committed to socialists and democratic socialists who worked in the soil, who were intellectuals, who read Marx and Freud and so on. On the other hand, my cousins are the Mea Shearim and Bnei Barak. They are the ultra, ultra, ultra religious with the peyote and with the huge fur hats. So, you know, I do love Israel. And it's a complicated country, but of course, it's a country that is also kind of a fantastic vision of possibilities. And when we came from Poland to Israel, I was so shocked when we said, "Look, there's a policeman. He's Jewish. There's a thief. He's Jewish. There's somebody washing a car. They're all Jews." It was the strangest thing because we didn't think Jews did those things.
Your time in New York, you went there when you're still very young. What was it about New York that made you feel this is my second promised land?
It was very easy because we moved to the Bronx. I spoke no English. We spoke no language. My parents were factory workers. We didn't have any money. We didn't know anybody outside of my aunt who lived in Pennsylvania and was hardly really alive. She was a survivor, but she was like the ghosts of the survival. But I fell in love with New York. All of us did because, you know, we lived in a neighborhood that had Jewish people, had Italians, had African-Americans, had Irish. Right away, you had that sense of being welcomed into this amazing melting pot. And it's not really a cliche because all my friends, I mean, my friend who taught me English was an Italian guy. I mean, his parents had just come from Italy. He spoke English better than I did. But I remember, you know, Tony giving me the words. I would say, you know, "What is that table? What is that, a cup?" So, you know, being an immigrant to America was something memorable because people welcomed us. And it was strange. We didn't speak, but people smiled. They patted us on the head. They were friendly. They were not people who seemed alien to us. Even though they look different, we never saw people like that in our lives before. So yes, America, I think, as I experienced it, was the homeland for immigrants, was free for, you know, to welcome the immigrants, just as it said on the Statue of Liberty by Emma Lazarus, you know, "Give me the poor, the tired, give me the rejects of the world, come here. This is the place where you can breathe free." And I certainly was breathing free when I came to New York.
Do you feel it's still like that?
Oh, yes. I mean, New York has, you know, it's grown. It's a complicated city. People might not love each other, but there is a tolerance in New York. There's a sense of community. And working at Ground Zero, I witnessed it, you know, after such catastrophes. People from all different backgrounds, different religions, ethnic backgrounds, did come together. And, you know, it's interesting. Of course, there are always the extremes that you read in the papers or you see on television. But New York is a macrocosm of the world. It's got everyone there.
I want to come on to your career, and we'll talk about some of the more famous projects that you've worked on in a moment. But one of the things that's quite striking about your work is that you're known for being an architect, and yet your first commission was when you're in your 40s?
I guess so, yes. Late 40s, probably.
So for that sort of, for the first sort of 20 or so years of your life, what did you consider yourself? What did you think your career was going to be like?
I really didn't think of a goal. You know, most of these business gurus tell you, you should have a goal and then try to get to your goal. I always thought something else. Don't have any goal. Have a path. And don't be pulled to the left or to the right. Just stay on this path and do what you love to do, which in my case was drawing, was thinking, was reading, was studying, was, you know, doing different things like that, building models, doing obscure things. But I stayed on that path. And that path took me to strange places that I would have never, if I willed them, you know, I always considered myself an architect. Even when I was teaching at Harvard, or when I had my own school of architecture, and when I was the head of a school of architecture at Cranbrook Academy of Art, I always thought I was an architect and I was going to build, but I didn't know how that would come to me.
When you say you knew you were going to build, do you feel like you were waiting for the right project?
Oh,
or
no.
was it a lack of sort of, not drive, because you're clearly incredibly driven, but was it a lack of sort of confidence that, yes, I can do this and I have all the tools to do it right now?
Well, the latter is true, but I kind of rejected. I tried working in an office for one day or 2 days with some famous architects. And I walked out and I said, this is not for me. I'm not going to sit at these desks in these quiet places. At that time, computers were not so prevalent, but they were so boring and so dull. I said, that's not what architecture is. I'm going to try to do it in another way. So I never apprenticed myself. I never worked for more than a day or two in an architecture milieu. And by the way, when I came to Berlin, unexpectedly, when I won the so-called first place in the what became later Jewish Museum, Berlin, we left this exhibition, which had like 200 projects, with a little certificate which said, you have won prize number one. And I turned to Nina, my wife and now partner, and I said to her, because we were heading to the Getty. I had this fantastic scholarship, fellowship from the Getty, which you don't even apply for, in Santa Monica, and we were on the way to Santa Monica. Then I said, you know, there are two roads diverging. One is going to Santa Monica, which is beautiful. It's continuing our beautiful academic kind of life. The other one is Berlin. Let's stay in Berlin. And she turned to me and said, to do what? I said, well, to try to build this building. And then she said the fateful words, but I've never even in my life been in an architect's office. And I said to her, the same applies to me. I've never been to an architect. I have no idea. I've never been to an architect's office. So that's how we started.
That project, the Jewish Museum in Berlin, incredibly difficult to pull off, you know, for various political reasons. Did you feel at any stage ever scared about taking it on, that essentially you're sort of saying to the world's Jewish population, don't worry, I'm going to do this, I'm going to make it great, there's going to be something fantastic for us there?
No, I never thought of that, because it was very controversial from the beginning. It didn't start as a Jewish museum. The competition was for the Berlin Museum with a Jüdische Abteilung, Jewish department. But, you know, coming from my background, I didn't have to study the Holocaust in libraries or archives. It was part of my life. So I said, you cannot do a Jewish Jüdische Abteilung. Jews were not a department of ethnographic history. Jews are part of Berlin. They're part of Germany, part of Europe. There was the Holocaust. There's the kind of void now in Berlin and in the world. I'm going to do something else. And I think my project was chosen because it was great to discuss, but no one had any intention to build it, I have to tell you. And
you think they weren't convinced about it at all?
No, usually, if you don't want to build something, you choose something that you can talk about, that gives kind of a substance. And that's not metaphorical, because I won the competition in 1989, before the wall fell. After the wall fell, I was walking on the street in Berlin, and an acquaintance of ours said, did you watch the news last night? I said, no. He said, well, they just reported that the government of Berlin unanimously voted to scrap your project. I said, what? He said, yeah, there was a unanimous vote of Parliament of Berlin. Now,
did you even know that there was going to be a vote?
No, of course not. Political blood is not inside of me. It's in Nina's veins, it runs all the time. So actually, I have to give the credit not to myself. It was thanks to Nina, who has a political mind, because I was ready to pack my suitcase. I mean, who's going to reverse a unanimous decision of a government? But she said, okay, don't think about it. Don't read the newspapers. Don't look at the news. Don't listen to the radio. Give me a little time. Be with the kids. Do whatever you want to do, but leave me alone. And somehow, with some articles in the press and some discussions, a discussion started all over Germany. Do we want such a museum? Do we need such a museum? Or should we spend the money on infrastructure, on a bid for the Olympics? Luckily for me, somehow the decision was reversed and the building was in process. But I never thought about it in those sense. What will it be like? Will people be satisfied? Will they not be satisfied? It was just a work. It was kind of a mission to build something that tells that story of the end. It tells the story of exile, but also tells the story of hope. Hope in a new time, in a new city, Berlin.
By the time it was completed, your father was around about 90?
Yes. Sorry. Yes.
Yeah. What did he make of it? What were his first impressions?
You know, when we moved to Berlin, almost all the members of our family ostracized us. Because like most people, we used to avoid Germany. You know, you never, if you were Jewish, you'd never go to Germany. You'd drive around to France just avoiding. So when we decided to move to Germany with our kids, three kids, including an infant girl, Rachel, people thought we were really insane. We were doing something terribly wrong. But my father, who was an elderly man, Holocaust survivor, came and he said, you know, you did the right thing. He stood there and he said, you know, we are here and there under us are the rotting bones of the Nazis. So he was the first to come. And he, you know, it's amazing that he had that vision that the world does change. It's not, some people say, oh, Berlin, Germany, it's this and this. No, he understood that it's about people. It's about individuals and there's a new generation. And I, quite frankly, felt better and better as I saw a younger generation. And all the people in our office, all the young architects, were very knowledgeable. They knew about the world. What their parents did, they also knew. But that change was something also very hopeful and I think powerful, and I liked it.
Memory plays a huge part in many of your projects, or certainly sort of many of your high-profile projects. Do you think actually memory plays a role in all forms of architecture, or at least it should play a role in all forms of architecture?
I think you're asking a very profound question. I think memory is not an additional factor. It's the fundamental dimension. It's the ground on which one can build. You cannot build just in the soil, you know, in the earth. You need to build in deep into the memory, because memory is the orienting device of the world. Without memory, we get kind of Alzheimer's cities where we don't remember, we don't think, we are lost. So memory is the Archimedean point, I would say, of architecture. And all classical architecture or ancient architecture I love had always understood that without that connection to deep memory, you cannot open any new horizon in space.
And yet, often architecture, you know, new buildings are described as, well, it's all about the new and the future, and it's not necessarily about building on the past. Often it's about erasing the past and trying to build a new future.
Well, sometimes people say, oh, this is strikingly new, but I consider myself actually a pretty traditional architect, using very traditional method and traditional thinking, the kind of liberal art thinking that, you know, you have to incorporate the dimensions of the liberal arts, free thinking, poetry, dance, music, astronomy, the world itself, that it's not just about the materials you're using and the techniques and strategies of construction. So it is a humanistic art. And to me, unless it tells a story, it's not architecture. It's a storytelling profession. And ironically, my grandfather, apparently, my father told me late in life, was, you know, this Jewish guy walking from shtetl to shtetl telling stories. That was his job. And that was a kind of a typical thing in that time. Every building tells a story. Even the most banal building that you see tells a very quick story, which is, I have nothing to tell you. It's a kind of Beckett. It's a short sentence of Beckett.
Do you feel there are quite a lot of those sorts of buildings?
Oh, yes. There's lots of buildings that have this deep, deep nothingness to them. where people just thought of, you know, a job. You know, they were finishing a job and they were getting some money for it and so on. And those buildings, you don't have to be an architectural expert to identify them very quickly, because you don't relate. They're very abstract. They have no emotional impact. They have no tradition in them. They're just anonymous.
Does that upset you?
No. Cities are made of all sorts of things. That's what makes cities so great. You've got the collision of all different differences. And it's the differences that make a city great. If a city was all of one kind, well, there is no such thing. That's the city's diversity. The city's creativity. The city is about the strangers. It's people who you don't know who will come onto the stage. And whenever I design something, I always think, not of the people I know, I think of the immigrants that might be coming in there who have a completely different background.
Let's talk about Ground Zero. You're the master planner for the rebirth of Ground Zero, which isn't just the new World Trade Center. It's a whole area, isn't it?
It is.
How, you know, we were talking before about how difficult it was to try and build a Jewish museum in Berlin. This must be up there in terms of the political issues that maybe you're trying not to deal with and getting other people to deal with, but it's a challenge,
isn't it? You have to deal with the political issues. The politeia, that's the city. It's politics. And in democracy, you have to forge a consensus. And I have so many stakeholders, the families of the victims and the thousands and thousands of people, the Port Authority, 7,000 engineers, architects, bureaucrats directed by the two powerful governors of New York and New Jersey, the streets of New York, you know, mayor of New York, the subways, the PATH trains, authorities independent. So you have a whole world of political powers. But my role was in the master plan, not just to draw a nice picture and hang it on a wall, which is what most master plans are, actually. They are never really accomplished. When they're built, there's nothing to do with the original drawings. But I wanted to assure that the composition that I wanted, and the idea, which is a spiritual idea, not only a technical idea, to emerge by a consensus. And how lucky I was that, look, of all the finalists in the competition, I was the only one to suggest not to build big buildings in the center of the site, to leave as much of it as open public realm for people, with the memorial, with the bedrock, with the slurry wall, with the wedge of light as an additional public space, with symbolic buildings that frame it, you know, 1776 Tower and so on. And that has happened. How it has happened, it's complicated.
And lots of compromises.
Well, you do a project in 6 weeks, and the project is going to be there for hundreds of years. You've got to be able to develop it with other people, with other interests, with more knowledge. So, of course, you have to. But it's not about the aesthetics of single buildings. I fought for what the public space would be like, the power of public space. And my idea was, how do you bring life, the victory of life, after these terrible events? And look, the proof is in the pudding. Over 100,000 people have moved to Lower Manhattan. It was empty when I came in. Now 120,000 people are living, families mostly, children, schools are being built. The epicenter of New York is in ground zero. And by the way, because I fought for slender towers, not the big, you know, trading floors that many developers wanted, now it is creative companies that have moved. It's not Wall Street. It's, you know, Condé Nast, it's Fox, it's creative media. And it's a totally different atmosphere. Hotels are moving in, retail. It's no longer the dead part of the town.
It's one of those rare projects that's taking place in a democracy. When we look at so many of the big projects that are taking place around the world now, they're often in countries where essentially an architect can come in and say, here's my plan, I want it done exactly like this, and it will be, because the people that live there will be moved out, because the government can just do that. It'll be made exactly to spec because they want a big showpiece thing to say, look at us, you know, look at what we're doing. Do you see the attraction of those sorts of projects where you can just come and say, I'm going to do it like this. I'm going to act like a dictator because I'm essentially working for a dictator.
You know, I've received at least 450 invitations like that, and I've rejected every one of them.
Why?
Because I love democracy, not rhetorically, but I am a product of democracy. I wouldn't be who I am if I didn't have the opportunities in an open society to argue, to think, to debate, to question. So to me, working democracy, as Churchill said, might be very, very difficult, but it's better than getting, here is a tabula rasa, so you can build yourself a great skyscraper in Shanghai or something like that. And I've gotten those invitations, and they don't have much interest for me. It's just my sensibility doesn't accept it.
What do you think when you see those buildings that go up in Doha or Dubai or in China or in Kazakhstan or wherever they are? Is there anything about them that you can admire or...?
No, not really. You know, I mean, I see them like the way we see new cars or washing machines or, you know, products of the industry of some sort that are commodities simply. Their spiritual meaning, and I don't mean to be in any sort of goofy way, but the fact that architecture is not just an intellectual discipline, there's a tradition there that it has to move the soul, just like a piece of music or a piece of literature, a poem has to move you somewhere. Without that, it's just a very impressive hollowness that is standing in front of you, no matter how many gymnastics have been performed on it, geometrically or artistically, or, you know, what kind of facades it has. All sorts of tour de force techniques are used, and I'm full of appreciation for them, but they don't move me.
Do you have dream projects that one day you hope you'll get a chance to work in a certain city or create a new memorial in a certain country? Are there these things in the back of your mind that you hope these things will
come
up?
No, they're in
up?
The front of my mind. I've designed several projects which are beyond working drawing stage in places which are today in turmoil. And these are projects that assert identities of peoples. They're highly important cultural projects to assert identity of people. I cannot reveal them because they're still under wraps.
But these are things that you've done yourself without necessarily talking to
with people involved and with clients and with budgets. These are real projects. These are not just hollow dreams. I'd love to build something in X or in Y. But unfortunately, I hope that perhaps this world situation will change for the better in this region. It's a troubled region, which we all know. And I will be able to build these buildings.
What still drives you now?
Well, the world, you know, is fractured by so many divisions. You know, fundamentalism, religious intolerance, income inequality, gender inequality, rejection of immigrants and migrants and a bigotry that we see even in our own country during the run-up to the elections. These are the things that I try to fight against. And a project could be a very modest project for a hospital that I'm building or for, you know, not mega projects, can be something that is important, even a small project that has a very different attitude to the world that says we care about the fact that we are here together, that we belong together, that we are not enemies of each other, that we like each other, that we share the same experiences. Now, I'm a believer in democracy, and I think the troubles we see are part of the fact that the world is inevitably being democratized.
Do you see yourself as an activist architect?
Well, activist with light, with concrete, with glass, with proportions. Yes, I mean, I can't be an activist linguistically, but I can do something to point something else in the space that I design. And I've always thought that space should communicate to you and not just confirm what you already know. We have to come to a point where we have to work with others. We can't simply draw lines in the sand and say, this is ours. You know, it's very difficult to divide. It's much easier to come together. And I think, I'm still an Israeli and I'm an American and I'm a Polish citizen as well. I think of the world. What is the world going to look like in the future, in 10 years and 15 years? What kind of world do we want? Do we want a world of conflict or do we want a world of peace? And I built, by the way, two museums that deal with wars. Imperial War Museum North in Manchester, which deals with ongoing conflicts, and the National Military Museum of Germany in Dresden. And both deal with the questions. Why do people follow leaders? Why do they engage in violence? Why?
But to go back to that specific issue of Israel right now, there are not many people saying those sorts of things in Israel, are there, at the moment?
I think Israel is a complicated country, and I think it's hard to say, yes, you know, it's black and white. The issues are complicated. I'm not a politician. I know how complex they are. You can see it by the negotiations of Kerry and Obama and the Iran deal. But, you know, we have to come out of the mentality, get out of it, because this is the 21st century. We have to see that there are other ways and completely other vectors and not be obsessed with things that are just lodged as obstacles to development.
You're an optimistic man, aren't you?
You know, I often consider that's the only quality you need to be an architect. You know, because you can be a pessimist as a general, or as a politician, as a leader of a country, or even as a poet and a filmmaker and a composer. You can be, you know, a pessimist. But because in architecture you are laying foundations always in the ground for something to be built, you have to believe in the future. You have to have hope. Otherwise, why would you bother?
Let's end it there. Daniel Liebeskind, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to The Big Interview with me, Steve Bloomfield, in conversation with Daniel Liebeskind. Next week, Georgina Godwin sits down with the journalist and activist Marianne Pearl. The Big Interview is produced by Bill Lutie, researched by Guy Lutz, and edited by Nina Narek. Don't forget to subscribe to this and any of our other programmes on Monocle 24. They can be found on iTunes, SoundCloud, or of course, monocle.com. I'm Steve Bloomfield. That was The Big Interview. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.